is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Kyle Cavanaugh from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years, and now with its integrated web platform, coaches have the ability to add video to plays and share them directly to their players' Android and iPhones via their mobile app. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. In addition to a great product, they also provide basketball coaching content and resources through their blog and Playbank. For access to these plays and more information, visit FastModelSports.com or follow them on Twitter at FastModel.
There's a variety of creative ways to score, even within a drill, that can help emphasize what you may need for your team in that moment.
Dan Evans is in his second season as head coach of the University of North Georgia men's basketball program after being named the fourth coach in the history of the program in April of 2019. In his first season at the helm, Evans led the Nighthawks to a PBC tournament berth after being picked to finish 10th in the preseason league poll. Evans came to UNG after a six-year stint as the head coach at NCAA Division II Ohio Dominican in Columbus, Ohio, where he led his team to 76 wins, including a 37-12 mark over his last two seasons. Evans was hired in May of 2013 by ODU to lead the Panthers after spending the previous six seasons as an assistant coach at Hillsdale College, where he was part of a coaching staff that rebuilt the Hillsdale basketball program. Evans played his collegiate ball at Lawrence University, a Division III school in Wisconsin, where he was a three-year starter and captain. He earned all-conference honors as a senior and helped take Lawrence to the Elite Eight in 2004. We recently launched the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavaliers Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, 305 Culture, Blazing the Path, Hashtag Lakers, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, Spanning the Spurs, and LA Hoops. Thunderous Applause is coming soon. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Go get some paper and pencil so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Dan Evans, head men's basketball coach at the University of North Georgia. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Dan Evans from the University of North Georgia. Dan, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to have you on, dig into all the great things that you've been able to do in the game. I want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember about them, and maybe what made you fall in love with the game.
You know, I really think it was pretty typical of a suburban kid. You know, I played Park District basketball in suburban Chicago. And at the time I was growing up, Jordan was playing for the Bulls. And obviously the Bulls were the biggest thing in the world at that point. And just kind of a sport that I played, to be honest. You know, I played soccer as a little kid and played baseball as a little kid and just kind of doing everything in the community and having fun with neighbors and friends. And, you know, just gradually over time, I kind of became a single sport athlete in terms of what I really, you know, cared about and worked at. And that was really basketball. And I don't remember as a little kid, you know, liking basketball any more than soccer or baseball, truthfully. But when I got into like probably late grade school and certainly into high school, it was really the only sport I played and had a passion for and really was bought into trying to be as good as I could be. But really a lot more than that for me was about just trying to win. You know, I wasn't, my players will probably laugh if they heard me say this, but I wasn't a big workout guy. I wasn't a big, you know, skill all the time guy, but I was really, really passionate about whatever I thought would help us win and whatever I thought, whatever kind of leadership role that it would take me or take us to be successful. I was pretty darn bought into that part of it, you know, the intangible qualities I thought it took to be successful. Certainly as I got later in high school, I felt like that was a real strength of mine and kind of spurred me going forward.
All right. I got a couple questions to play off of what you just said. So the first one is you grow up playing multiple sports and basketball eventually becomes the one that you gravitate towards. Any reason other than the fact that you just thought basketball was more fun than the other sports? Was there some piece of it that really attracted you to it? The way that it was maybe an outlet for your competitiveness, or you just like the ability to go out and practice on your own. What was it about basketball that made you choose that over some of the other sports you played when you were younger?
That's a good question because my dad, you know, when I was younger, probably into college, maybe just after college, would occasionally express to me that I was a better soccer player than I was a basketball player. And I was not a great basketball player. I mean, I ended up playing at a really good Division III school and stuff like that, that we'll get into, I'm sure. But I just liked to practice basketball more than I liked practice of soccer when it came down to it. You know, I liked to play in games when it came to soccer, especially leading into high school. But I found myself not very enthusiastic about really going to practice. You know, I can remember sitting in my dad's car, and he coached a lot of my youth teams, particularly in soccer, and just kind of feeling like I was going because I liked to be around my dad, you know, and I liked to spend that time together, and I know he enjoyed it. And so at some point, I probably got the courage or at least, you know, enough sort of age and standing to be like, hey, I just don't want to play anymore. And I just want to play basketball. And I don't know if there was like a pinpoint thing other than I didn't have any issue practicing basketball. You know, I was always excited. I was always liked that form of competition. And when it came to soccer, I was like, I don't really want to do this part of it anymore. And that kind of tipped the scales, I think, for me.
Yeah. When it's something that you don't enjoy putting the time in and working at, I think that's something that you learn, especially as a parent, because you have these ideas of what you think your kids might do or what you might want them to do. And then you realize that if you're taking them to activities that they don't really enjoy, that they don't want to participate in, it quickly becomes not very much fun for them and not very much fun for you as a parent. And so I think it's important to expose kids to a lot of different things and then kind of have them find their path of what it is that they want to do. And it sounds like sort of that's what happened to you as you were exposed to a bunch of different sports and then eventually just kind of weeded your way out of the other ones and found your way to basketball. Because as you said, it was just something that you loved to do and that you had a passion for. When you think about that time when you switched over to becoming focused more on basketball. And you mentioned that, you know, what you really liked to do was go out and play and be competitive and not necessarily be the workout guy or the skill development player. And of course, again, comparatively to when you were growing up in the game, to where youth basketball and high school basketball is today, a lot of those things that kids do today in terms of working with an individual skills trainer or some of the workout stuff that kids do were things that, I know I'm 50, so all that stuff, none of that existed when I was a kid. And for you, you're a little bit younger than me, but at the same time, that wasn't nearly as prevalent. So when you're thinking about your development as a player compared to the development of your players today, how would you compare the two? And what did you like about the way that you grew up in the game, maybe compared to the way kids grow up in the game today?
I think what you're saying is 100% the case, you know, and I don't feel like I'm very old. You know, I'm 37 years old. And yet what one of my players has gone through in his development to get to this place is just way different than what the equivalent player was going through, you know, in the whatever that would be mid to late 90s into the very early 2000s. And I think it is very different. And I do think the idea of being able to play multiple sports for me was a huge benefit. You know, I think it unlocked some things from a mental standpoint that allowed me to be a better basketball player. I think it also allowed me to be competitive in a variety of environments. And I think there are times today where those opportunities are not always there for our young people to be competitive in a variety of environments. And so I do think the freedom, and let's be honest, I was not talented enough to think that, you know, I was certainly going to be a professional player. I'm sure at one time I probably hoped and probably told my parents I wanted to get a scholarship, but, you know, there were just some gifts I wasn't provided with physically, you know, that were going to always hold me back as it relates to that stuff. But it wasn't an expectation for us to do skill workouts on a day-to-day basis. Like the idea of having a trainer, an individual skills trainer, it just hadn't been popularized in the mainstream. I'm sure elite level players were probably already, you know, that world was developing, but it wasn't for, quite honestly, a Division III player like I was. You know, it wasn't really for us at that point. I don't think that's really good or bad, truthfully. I just think it hadn't come to the forefront and hadn't really been sort of brought to that population. And I think there is a big difference in that our players are more skilled in their ability to do certain things, in particular play with the ball in their hands than I was, you know, but I was forced to learn things kind of mentally, competitively, that I think at times there can be some stunting of that growth with the volume of skill training that people have access to today. And really the best players find their way to doing both. You know, they find their way to being able to do both and allow them to be as skilled as they're capable of being at that point of their development, while still knowing how to compete and knowing how to fight to win in whatever it is they're doing.
I think you're 100% right. And I think the positives to me of the system that you and I maybe grew up with is that competitive piece of it, that if you're at the park and you lose a game, and you know you're going to have to sit out for the next hour and a half, kind of motivates you to want to play a little bit harder. And yet at the same time, I think you look at it, you made a great point about players today, I think being far more skilled. I look at it maybe not as much at the college level, at least when I think of it in my mind, I think about high school players. And I go back to the time when I was playing in high school or even 10 or 15 years ago, and you had players 10, 11, 12 on the end of that bench that probably weren't that skilled. Maybe you had a football guy who was just out there to be a rebounder and set some screens. And now you have kids 1 through 12 that all can shoot and all can handle the ball. And as you said, every kid is more skilled with the ball in their hands. But I think the one area that maybe is lacking, in addition to the competitiveness sometimes, is that IQ, because they spend so much time working on skills in isolation as opposed to really putting them to use in a game. And so it's a challenge, I think, as a coach to be able to figure out, what do I have to give my players? What is it that they need? And how do I design my practices, my workouts in order to take advantage of that? So when you think about trying to instill competitiveness in your players or trying to help them improve their basketball IQ, what are some things that you do as a coach, whether it's in the off season or through your practice design, that helps you to build on those two things, IQ and competitiveness?
I want to touch on one thing you said. I think one of the other differences relative to age is just we didn't play as many structured games as people do now.
Absolutely.
You got to, you know, I can remember playing in like the, at one time it was called the Cary Grove Hoop Fest in suburban Chicago, and they had the Crystal Lake South Hoop Fest or Hoop, what was it, Gary Collins Shootout or whatever it was called. And like those were our summer tournaments, and that's, those are the only games we would play all summer. And so we had to wait again until, you know, whenever we started about Thanksgiving in Chicagoland. And like it was really important to play any structured setting because you just didn't have that many chances. And so I think that like heightened importance was sort of instilled in us in a way because we weren't going to get to play in May, June, July, you know, April, May, June, July, right? We weren't going to get to play all those months still. And so that from a competitive standpoint and really more of an like an urgency and a valuing standpoint, maybe even more than competition, like we had to value it because it wasn't coming again. You know, it wasn't coming again until we got into Thanksgiving and you know, you were suiting up for your high school team.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think about the added importance that games took on for me. So when I was in high school in the state of Ohio, our regular season was 20 games. And then really, there was almost little to no AAU basketball. Certainly, nobody would recognize what AAU basketball looked like when I was playing in the late 80s. Doesn't look anything like it did today. And to your point, maybe I would play in one or two tournaments in the summer where you're getting maybe three, four, five games. So over the course of a calendar year, I was playing maybe 20 regular season high school games. And then depending on how far you get in the tournament, you play another two, three, four games. Then you have some AAU tournaments in the summer where maybe you're playing another 10 games, maybe. So I'm looking at 35 games total. Sometimes players today are playing 35 games in the course of a month when you figure they're going to a tournament every weekend and they're playing six or seven games in that weekend. And every game, just like I heard you describing, every game to me when I was a high school player or even as a college player, every game meant something to me because there were just relatively few of them. And I think that fueled that piece of the competitiveness from a structured standpoint. And then as I said earlier, I think playing on the playground where you go and either you play and you keep winning or you play and you lose and you sit, that's pretty motivating when you get yourself up to a playground or to a park. Or I used to drive around the city of Cleveland to try to find games at different places. And you go there and you take all that time to get to a gym. And then all of a sudden you play one game up to 11 and you're done and you lose and you got to sit for an hour. That's pretty motivating to not want to have to do that again.
No doubt. And I think that's one of the great advantages of being, you know, sort of self-confident enough and willing enough to explore and go play in that environment, right? I mean, it's something that doesn't occur as often, it doesn't seem like now, because there's just so much availability of gyms and whatnot and structured environments, which also have really positive things, safety maybe being at the forefront of it.
Absolutely.
But I do think you gain so much. And that's one thing I probably just missed out on. You know, I was pretty far out in the suburbs. I probably just missed out on, you know, being able to go to a park and really play good players. You know, we played in the park, but it was ultimately the same guys I would have been practicing against and all that stuff. But certainly there's that blacktop experience that is unique and irreplaceable.
Yeah, and it's not coming back. I think, unfortunately, I think the way that the system is set up from there's a lot of different reasons why it's gone away. And I've said it on the podcast a bunch of times, but I really feel like some of my best moments in the game of basketball were on the playground. I mean, just in terms of my experiences with the people that I played with on the playground, with just being able to have fun. You think about why you started playing basketball, and you didn't do it because you were going to get some kind of accolades as a high school player, or that you were going to go and be able to have a chance to play college basketball or this or that. You started out doing it because it was fun. And some of the most fun moments that I've ever had, regardless of whatever I achieved in my playing career, some of the most fun moments were just on the playground, hanging out with guys that I played with all the time and had fun with. And again, people of all different ages and from all different backgrounds and all over the place. And I don't think it's coming back. And again, as an old guy, it's unfortunate. I look back on it very, you know, very nostalgically. But yet at the same time, I think if I had come up in this era and had an opportunity to play 70 games over the course of a summer, I probably would have been just as into that as I was into playground basketball back in my era.
Yeah, and I think one of the things you're talking about that I feel like was helpful to developing a competitiveness and an IQ, you know, to go back to your question about what we do in practice, is like playing one-on-one, playing two-on-two, playing three-on-three, four-on-four, you know, playing in small-sided sort of settings to give people a different feel and different set of things that you have to consider. You know, how you play two-on-two carries over to five-on-five, but certainly you have to be more worried about different things, right? And the same thing with three-on-three and four-on-four. And that is actually one way that we, you know, do our best to try to provide our players kind of outlets to advance their understanding. And sometimes those setups are, you know, very specific structures of, hey, we're going to run this movement to get started in a three-on-three or a four-on-four, and then you're playing with no restrictions. Or sometimes it's, hey, we're playing four-on-four, but you can only post up and penetrate. You can't screen anywhere. You know, then, you know, maybe we'll play — this isn't as much for us now with the way we play, but certainly in my past we've played where, hey, you can't dribble at all. So now you can screen and post and move anywhere, but you literally can't dribble, and you're still trying to score. You know, you're still trying to make plays in that way. And so those are some ways that really we're developing IQ and in a more live setting. Obviously, we have a certain amount of repetition of, you know, hey, just, you got to go do this movement, reading it in this way. And like, okay, now they guard it this way. Go do this movement, and just kind of training you in that way. And the other thing is we're trying to make as many of those things like pointed, you know, or competitive in a literal sense, keep score in as many settings as we can. Like for us right now, we have a set of like gold — one of our sort of secondary colors is like a yellow gold. And so we have a gold, two sets of gold headband and wristbands. And literally I hand wrote, like, you know, like Jim McMahon used to do in the Bears. I hand wrote on these headbands, rebound.
You didn't write Roselle on there?
Yeah, something like that. I wrote rebound. And so we give those out after each sort of stretch of practices to, you know, a group of guards and a group of front court players. And whoever has the most rebound in each group gets to wear any combination of them that they want. And it's really silly, right? And even saying it out loud, I'm kind of laughing to myself. And yet there's a pride that goes with that. You know, there's a pride that goes with being recognized, and in this case, it's for rebounding. And so the other thing we have is a pair of gold shorts. And I know we're not unique in this way, but the player who wins essentially the most drills wears the gold shorts for the next set of practices. And again, is it the most important thing? Are they really much different than our practice shorts? No, but somebody gets to spend those 2, 3, 4 days, whatever we have in a row, you know, being recognized. And that's for winning 2-on-2 and 1-on-1. And, you know, you get points for winning any drill. And so those are some ways that we're trying to foster both IQ and competitiveness as much as we can.
Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit SnapRaise.com and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time. I want to dig into exactly how you score things and maybe give us some examples of exactly what maybe a drill or two look like that you score. But before you do that, I want to say that the headbands and the shorts, as you were saying that, and you're saying, boy, I'm kind of laughing about this kind of in the back of my head as I'm saying it out loud. And I think one of the things that we forget as we get to be adults is how important those silly little things are. And even though, as you said, when you say it out loud, you're like, really? Like, this is motivating college athletes to be able to put on a goofy yellow headband or some yellow shorts. And yet you forget that as kids, those things are so, so important. That recognition, that just something tangible that they can hold on to that is proof that they've done a good job. Or I often think about how important, I don't know how you were, but when I was growing up, even when I was in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, the number that I got for my jersey or my t-shirt for my team was so critically important to me. Like, that was one of the most important things in my life, was what number I was going to get to wear. And you think about that now as an adult and you're like, what did it even matter? Like, who cares? And sometimes as a coach, I've been guilty of this with my own kids. Like, you're passing out whatever t-shirts for the jersey number or whatever, and everybody, you know, it's just, okay, we got five larges, we're going to just give any kid whatever. And you forget how important those numbers are. You forget how important the yellow headbands are, or how important the yellow shorts are, that recognition. We had a JV coach that was part of my high school program, and I never played for him because I went from ninth grade to the varsity, but he was the JV coach while I was in high school. And he always would give out an orange juice whenever a player would get a charge. And literally, players on his team, year after year after year, would kill themselves trying to take charges so that the next day at school, they would get multiple orange juices. Like, it was this huge sense of pride if you could sit at the lunch table with three orange juices that you had earned for taking charges. And I think as coaches, we forget how important that stuff is sometimes.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I have a couple things about this, actually. One is sort of what I perceive as a failure of mine. We had a year, it was one of my last 2 years at Ohio Dominican, and we had a similar idea to the sort of gold shorts, what is often referred to as like the points game. And what we were going to do it as like more of a lunch pail, you know, for like, you know, rebounds, deflections, charges, like those kind of hustle sort of stats. And similar to the gold shorts, whoever had the most of the previous set of practices would literally get a lunch pail. And I bought a black sort of steel lunch pail. And we efforted to do it, and it became somewhat more difficult to track than we thought. And so it kind of just petered out a little bit, you know, unfortunately. And I really feel like, looking back, it was in the moment I felt like we had failed, but I didn't really see a path for us to continue it. And it was probably 2 or 3 months later, and one of our guys, one of our best players, like, came in and was like, hey, whatever happened to that lunch pail? And like, I was like, oh, you know, I didn't really know where it was even, honestly, at that moment. And he's like, I really liked that. And I remember thinking, like, darn, man, like, and we liked the idea, certainly, we implemented it. But exactly like you're saying, like, there was value to it. It was this little tin black lunch pail. I don't even remember if we decorated it. And like, there was value to being the person who had won it. You know what I mean? There was status to being the person that had won it. And you do. You kind of forget how people want to be rewarded, and they really want to be measured. you know, they want to be measured in some way, shape, or form to their performance. And the other thing is, we do this thing called the $1 Million Challenge, and we started it when I my first year at Ohio Dominican, and it's a layup, a free throw, a top of the key three, and a half court shot. And if you make them all, I tell the guys I'll buy them. If you make them all, and we do it at walkthrough the day of games, I will buy you a lotto ticket for you for a chance to win $1 million.
Nice.
And, you know, the whole thing is that after you graduate, however many you win, and this kind of developed over time, you know, I'll give those to you. And it is unbelievable. And you only get one chance, but it's unbelievable how focused people get to try to make this silly little challenge, and how like people pay attention and they watch. And when somebody gets it, you know, it's not the biggest deal in the world, but like people are genuinely enthusiastic about it. And it's all about just recognizing and just, you know, sometimes providing an honor, a privilege, a whatever, and how much that does sort of resonate with all of us, but most especially young people.
For sure. So does every kid get one opportunity at the day before a game practice? Is that how it works?
It is at walkthrough itself. So we do day of game walkthroughs or shoot arounds. And it is if we're not going to, we give it at the end of practice the day before. But generally it's, hey, we have a walkthrough in the morning or the afternoon, whatever it is relative to our game time. And that's the last thing we do before we huddle and generally go eat. And so it's like when we're depending on our schedule, like I will literally make it so that if you know, as soon as you miss, you got to get the heck out of the gym, you know, and I'll like send people off the court and just kind of laugh and, you know, be sarcastic and joke around with people. But, you know, I'll make them go sit on the bench once they've missed. And, you know, it's just lighthearted, but the idea of getting to win this lotto ticket that is way down the line of their careers most of the time is still a lot for them and a lot of excitement.
This is going to be a great story like 30 years from now when one of your kids hits on the lottery.
Yeah. I establish an agreement that I take 10%, period.
Nice.
Whatever you win, 10% of that's coming to Coach Evans, and that's after their taxes. So I'm avoiding the government as much as I can on that front.
I like it. I like it. That's very cool. I've never heard that idea. I think it's a great idea. It's brilliant that, as you said, it's just a fun way. I'm sure it's something that the kids look forward to every single time. And as you're saying it, I can just picture what that would be like, both from watching it as a coaching staff and also participating in it as a player. I could see how fun it would be. And then the other thing that you talked about with the lunch pail, and this is something that I've come up against and for various reasons, but I tend to be a person, a lot of my coaching in recent years has been with my own kids, where typically it's me and maybe one other person coaching, you know, somebody else's dad typically. And I'll find that I'll have these ideas kind of like, whether it's the lunch pail or I've done other things where I have this grand idea that I'm going to keep track of wins and losses and drills, and I'm going to chart this or chart that. And then inevitably what ends up happening to me is I'm only one person and my assistant can't make it to a practice for whatever reason. And now I'm trying to chart this and keep track of that. And it always ends up going south at some point, and I can never finish off these great ideas that I always have. So maybe just give people an idea about how you put together your point system. Give us one or two drills maybe that you do chart, and then what your system is for keeping track of that stuff. Who does it? And then how does it get back to you, and how do you record keep for that?
Yeah, so that what you're talking about, it throughout my career has been the challenge, right? Is actually tracking and staying consistent with it. And so right now I got the points game idea. We used to do it years ago and then kind of brought it back after some conversations with some good friends of mine in the coaching world, and just there doing it. And I was just honestly a couple of days before practice this year, a regular season start, I was just kind of like, let's do it. And so we keep it as simple as if you win a drill, you get a point. If you take a charge, you get 2 points. And it's that simple. And our graduate assistant, Jordan Magruder, is responsible just for keeping it right on his practice plan. So it's not like overly complicated. It's not a big to-do. It's just he tallies it right there. I think he has a little, you know, an area with each guy's name right below the plan itself. And then we have a student assistant right now who's one of our former players who is finishing up school. And he's responsible to track rebounds. And so he has a clipboard. And he literally, even while he's coaching, he just has it right with him. And when we play live drills, he just flips it over and then he just tracks those rebounds. And so we try to keep it that simple. I think the points game in particular is something that even if I was a solo coach, I do think I could track that element of it. And then we don't necessarily record keep beyond the stretch of practices. So if we have three in a row, we name the winner, and then we don't necessarily keep it beyond that, though I know some programs do keep like long record books of who wins what. We haven't really graduated to that. So we do. We try to keep it as simple as possible, and it actually dovetails into some of what we try to do in terms of scoring our drills. You know, in the past, I've done things where – you know, you're giving points for rebounds, losing points for turnovers, twos and threes, sometimes even incentivizing specific kinds of scores. So layups are double, inside out threes are double. And I like that we have gone, I don't want to say the opposite way, but we've tried to simplify our scoring of drills just because it our players, it makes it simpler on them. You know, they understand more clearly what's winning and what's losing within it. But certainly there's a variety of creative ways to score, even within a drill, that can help emphasize, you know, what you may need for your team in that moment.
What are some of the small-sided game drills that you like to use? Or maybe just what are some of the constraints that you like to set up heading into, let's say you're going to do a three-on-three you talked about, maybe doing specific actions. Do you build those off of actions that you run in your offense? Do you sometimes, if the focus is defensively, do you focus on what maybe your opponent's going to do, some actions? Just talk a little bit about how you design those small-sided games to try to get the most benefit out of it for your players.
Yeah, so some of that, the last part is really based on when we are during the year. So like at this point in time, we're really doing actions – particularly 3-on-3 that are for us, you know, and so we will play 3-on-3 games where you get a single action and the kind of result of it. So this simple way to think of it is, hey, we're going to have a wing ball screen and we're going to lift out of that wing ball screen. And essentially you get that action and the resulting advantage that you have to score. And so those possessions might be 4, 5, 6 seconds long, but you're still forced to guard. You're still forced to play offense in a live manner. But once it's sort of controlled, the whistle just blows. And you keep playing really till the whistle blows. But we as coaches, myself and really my lead assistant, you know, we're blowing the whistle if it feels like it's gone just a little too far. And that those type of things will mostly just be about us. You know, stuff that we want to do, we want to get better at in a live setting, but also not leave it to the chance of playing 5-on-5 and hoping we get repetition at it. And that's actually something that we used to do years ago when we played 5-out motion. You know, we would do 3-on-3 on a side. So you had to stay on your side. And we were really more focused on off-ball screening at that point. And so you would play 3-on-3 on a side and you could use a passer on the other side that was part of your team. And you would get different screening varieties. You know, you could read and feel and curl and separate and do everything really, but you had to confine yourself to that side. And you really, I don't remember if we gave him a time constraint, but you know, you had the opportunity to do it and continue to do it. And then you would, sometimes we'd make it a 5-on-5 drill where one side went 3-on-3, you didn't score, you scored. And then you had your two other players playing 2-on-2 on the other side with a passer. And so your sort of whole group of five
was getting opportunities to rep these individual spacing and actions that you had to read and decide, but it was competitive. You know, you were keeping score and the other team was guarding you. And so those are some examples of a sort of smaller side. When we get to 4-on-4, it's really a mixture of screening action that we want to learn how to defend or rep defending. So that's a good amount of it, especially when we get into the season. We may use 4-on-4s as sort of scout time. You know, some teams running screen the screener, you know, we're going to set that screen the screener up in a 4-man setting and make it be live. And once we're done with the action, it's live playing the way we play. And in other cases, we'll run our stuff out of that same setup.
So you mentioned a little bit about how in years past, when you're running a motion offense and there was so much more off-ball screening, and the game has clearly morphed and changed to where you have a lot more ball screen offense, and clearly then defensively you have to be able to be prepared to defend a ball screen. I tell people all the time that when I think back to my playing career, late 80s, early 90s, I can probably count the number of times on one hand that I ran a ball screen, and then also probably the same thing as far as defending a ball screen. It almost was non-existent. You had much more of the motion offense type of basketball being played back in that time. So how have you seen the game change, and why do you think it's evolved? Obviously, probably taking the lead from the highest level, the NBA, as the pick and roll has become more important in the league. It's trickled down into the lower levels of basketball. But just what's your feeling about how the game has changed, both from a pick and roll standpoint and just from an emphasis on the three-point line being so important in today's game?
Yeah, I think, you know, so I went to Lawrence University, a Division III school in Appleton, Wisconsin, and I played for a man named John Tharp, who really we ran, you know, Dick Bennett, Bobby Knight style five-out motion, you know. And so we really learned how to cut, move, screen without the ball in our hands. I don't really, we didn't dribble the ball, quite honestly, all that much in my memory. Certainly relative to watching a game today, we didn't dribble the ball all that much. And I had the same experience personally. Like, I don't know that I came off more than a handful of ball screens in my life. And so that was how we were taught to play. We played a little bit like that in high school at Cary Grove. I honestly don't remember as well how much emphasis was on it at that point. And then I ultimately went to work for Coach Tharp at Hillsdale College in Michigan, and we ran the same stuff. And so when I got to Ohio Dominican, that is what I walked in kind of believing we would run. And as it turned out, we were in the middle of a city for one at Ohio Dominican, right in the middle of Columbus, Ohio. And it really, I just felt like there was more players that could play with the ball in their hands at that point. And so we just kind of took a lot of the principles we talk about in our off-ball screening when I was a true pure motion person and just kind of put those two on the ball, you know, created movement and reactions and not that we created them, but really dug into what different people were doing. Most especially, I felt like the Spurs were really at the forefront of what we were sort of emulating just because they had movement along with the on-ball stuff. And so really from that time, it was kind of tinkering with what we thought worked, paying attention to what other people were doing, and both at the NBA level, college, small college, and just kind of tinkering to get to a place that we felt like we liked what we were trying to accomplish. And I don't think it's good or bad, honestly. I think style of play is exactly that. It's what suits your kids best, what suits your athletes best, and ultimately that's going to be what's best for you.
Where do you go to try to find things that you want to incorporate into what you do with your program from an X's and O's standpoint? Do you tend to find yourself in the off season watching other college programs? Do you find yourself gravitating towards NBA actions? Is there some other source that you go to when you're trying to think of innovative ways or things that you can incorporate into what you do with your program. Where do you go to find those things?
I would say I more lean toward college programs of really at any level. I think when we get to conference tournament time of the Division I level, you begin to get the opportunity to more easily act. And we have synergy. So, I mean, I guess I always have easy access, but you know, you get the opportunity to watch people at the most important games of their season, right? Conference semifinals, conference finals, of all sorts of leagues and sort of strata of the Division I world. And I feel like that's probably a time that my interest gets peaked and I begin to, and it's obviously coincides with our year having, you know, sort of ending or getting near the end or having just ended. And so I would say that's at the forefront. I watch the NBA. I think it's incredible, but it is a different game. I mean, it just is a different game than what we're doing day to day, both the skill and ability of all the players and beyond that, just the size and athleticism of everybody. You know, it's just not the same for us at the college level, in my opinion, at any level. It's just totally different. And so I definitely lean more toward the NBA or toward the college and try to understand and see other, Division II and Division III teams, honestly, you know, and a lot of my coaching friends and connections just happen to be in the Division III world because of the path I've taken to coaching and through coaching. And so I see some amount of Division III basketball, probably more than would be a normal Division II coach. And obviously get a deep immersion in Division II basketball, you know, for over a decade now.
Clearly that's something where you are familiar with the level where you coach at, and you tend to make your friends and be able to see and go and observe and watch and the teams that you're playing against and steal and borrow. And clearly you're watching a lot of film on the teams that you play. And so you're always, I'm sure, picking things up. Do you want to score more? Training with the Shotacle is the easiest way to score more. The game is changing and data scientists are determining the best ways to score. Millions of computer simulations determine where to hit the backboard for the highest percentage shots and when it's best to use the backboard. The Shotacle provides those highest percentage shots. From beginners to next level athletes, the Shotacle is helping players increase their shooting percentages. Visit Shotacle.com now and start scoring more. So let's go backwards in time to talk a little bit more about your path. So first, let's go back to your recruitment and what that looked like and just your college decision when you're thinking about the way that you went about making your college decision, and then think about whether or not any of those lessons are applicable to players out there, or what you've learned as a coach, what you learned from your own experience as a player being recruited to go play college basketball.
Yeah, so I was a high school basketball player at Cary Grove High School, the northwest, far northwest suburbs of Chicago. We were a good high school team. You know, we ended up getting beat. Illinois at that time was two classes, and we won our sectional, which was the first team, I think, in our league's history to win the sectional, which is essentially four games, you know, winning four games. And so we were in the final 16 of 2A, which was the bigger of them. We got beat in overtime at the mark of the Quad Cities by Moline, and really what was kind of a devastating loss. If we had won, we'd have gone downstate, which for an Illinois was in Peoria. And, you know, the final eight played at Bradley or at the Peoria Civic Center, I think, actually. I was not a highly recruited player. You know, I think I had some conversations with Bucknell because I had good academic scores, and I would have never been good enough, quite honestly, to play at Bucknell, in my opinion. I had Division IIIs, you know, the CCIW, the Lawrence, which was in the Midwest Conference, and a couple other Midwest Conference schools. And
I visited, I think, DePauw and Elmhurst and North Central, which are all Division III schools, and had talked to Augustana and Beloit and Lawrence, and I'm sure there were others, but those are the ones that I kind of remember. And the reality for me is, like, I really wasn't enthusiastic about going away to college. You know, I felt I was really worried about being homesick and all those kind of things. And I ultimately chose Lawrence because I just felt comfortable there. It just felt like the place I was supposed to be. Coach Tharp, his personality is very outgoing and very comfortable in his skin. And I don't think I was those things at that point. And so I think he made me feel good because of that. And Coach Juckum, who was the assistant at that time and is now the head coach at Wash U in St. Louis. And, you know, they made me feel like I belonged, and I felt like I belonged in that environment. And I think because I just felt at home, it ultimately just, I just believed it was the place I was supposed to be. And so I know I visited at least one other place after that, just was kind of like, I just didn't feel the same. And the thing I really believed, and certainly after going through the experience at Lawrence, believe even more, is if you fit in at a place, you're going to have a better experience. If it fits you and you're going to be comfortable there and be given an opportunity to grow there, you're going to be better off. You know, the relationships I have from my college experience are a result of me and my teammates being there for 4 years together as classmates, at least, and being around the class ahead of me for 3 years and being around the class behind me for 3 years. And, you know, that length of development and relationship, and we were successful, certainly was, I think, part of it too. But the fact that we got to grow and go through adversity and win ultimately together, and honestly have a lot of what I'm sure were foolish experiences off the floor, like that was incredibly valuable and the stuff that to this day I cherish. And so I think when we're recruiting student athletes, like that's a big thing for me. Like, you know, they have to fit in. We have to believe in them, obviously, but we got to believe that our university, whatever it happens to be in right now at the University of North Georgia, we have a tremendous place to provide an opportunity, but we got to believe that it works for them. You know, that our program works for them, the university works for them, and that environment works for them, because I believe people should be at places for extended periods of time, because that's where all the great growth really lies.
So when you're recruiting a kid and you're trying to figure out whether or not they're a good fit for your program, obviously the first thing is there has to be a certain level of talent that they need to have out on the basketball floor in order for you to even consider recruiting them. But then when you start looking at how is this kid going to fit into what we're trying to do, how do you go about determining whether or not that kid's going to be a good fit? Are there questions that you're asking? Are there things that you're looking for? Are there people you want to talk to? What's the process for figuring out if they're a good fit for your program?
I mean, I think all those things you're saying are part of them, right? You know, we high school coaches, AAU coaches, if they have, you know, individual trainers, conversations with them, their family, the visit is really important to me, both any sort of shorter visit that's, you know, just unofficial and spending a few hours together. Like, I think there's a lot to be gathered through that. And honestly, a certain amount of it is like, watch them. You know, watch them, watch their body language, watch the way they interact with people. How are they in your conversations? Can they follow through with the things you're asking them? Do they demonstrate some interest, you know, back toward you? And I think it's an old Bill Parcells quote, you know, of when someone shows you who they are, believe them. And I think when we get into these processes, people oftentimes they are who they are, especially at that point in their development. And you got to trust that what you see and what you're hearing is right and real if you can back it up with tangible examples. And so, you know, some of it's what kind of school you at, right? Like, can that person succeed academically there?
Are there things for them in terms of major and course of study that are going to satisfy them? Socially, is it going to be a comfortable environment? Are they going to be okay with what a normal student is at your school? Does that fit for them? Are they not, they don't have to be the same, but are they going to be comfortable and okay with that being the normal regular student, so to speak? For us, it's a big, we want people that value education. They don't have to be perfect academic profiles, but they need to, it for them and their parents, quite honestly, we need to believe that education and that degree is going to be important, and doing well in the process of it is going to be important. And we want people with high character that can fit in, but also are going to be able to love other people and respect them and value the experience. And so the conversations, the questions, the body language, the all the interactions kind of cumulatively kind of ultimately shed as much light as we're going to get.
When you go out and you are evaluating a player, this is a question that I find myself asking to a lot of college coaches now. How do you balance what you see from a player during their AAU season versus their high school season? In other words, when you go watch them play in each of those environments, are you looking for something different in each environment? Is there something that you can pull from one that maybe is more difficult to pull from the other? And then which evaluation do you put more stock in? Maybe you don't put more stock in either one of them. Maybe it's equal, but just give me your ideas, your feelings about recruiting and watching a player during their high school season versus their AAU season.
Yeah, I think there's value in both. I think this is a really challenging area for me personally, at least. There is so much AAU basketball. There's just so many people playing that I think it can be difficult based on what environment you see them play in, even within AAU. I mean, I'm always a fan, and I think as time has gone on, I seem to value this more and more, that I want to see our potential players play against the best competition that they're going to face, and that doesn't mean that they have to always be great in those moments, but it's like, what do they do when they play good players? What do they do when they play in high leverage games, whether that be region tournaments, state tournaments, just a rivalry game, obviously championship games and such. And, from an AAU setting, there are those high leverage games relative to the sort of tournament format, but also, hey, you're going to play a really good team that maybe has several scholarship level players. What do you look like? How comfortable are you? Can you hold up? What do you do? And I really like to see kids in both environments, meaning both AAU and high school, because you might play for your AAU team and you're the fourth best player, and so you have a role to fulfill. And can you fill that role? Okay, you go to your high school team, maybe you're the best player, and that role is certainly different. And can you fill that role too? Because I think that takes great maturity and understanding and IQ to be able to do both, and toughness to do both those things separately in separate environments. And so I don't know if one's more important than the other than to say I have grown in my desire to see people in the best games. Like an 8 a.m. game against a team that you're way better than in an AAU environment, like I'm just not sure what real information we're going to get out of that. Whereas you're going to play a team that's really good and you're on a really good team, whether it's AAU or high school for that matter. And what do you do then? What do you do in that moment? So it's kind of a balance, honestly.
Yeah, I think being able to step up to that challenge, and clearly when you're talking about the AAU environment, you have a wide range of the types of games that I'm sure you see. So you have that 8 a.m. game that you described where you're playing against a team that you're probably going to beat by 40. And then you do have more higher leverage games where you have a lot of college players on the floor at the same time. And I'm sure then that allows you to see more of what that kid can do in an environment that's similar to what they may participate in once they get to your university. And so I think about just the difference between the two, and I think about how the AAU culture kind of goes back to what we talked about a little earlier, how the AAU circuit has grown. And as you said, there's so many kids playing now versus it used to be a much more selective process in the past. And I would have to think that it makes it, and to go along with the fact that we talked about kids being more skilled, do you think recruiting has gotten harder or easier in the time that you've been in coaching?
That's a good question. I think there's more noise to sift through than when I feel like, you know, I started at Hillsdale in May of 2007, you know, going to the Spiess Run-In Slam of what would have been probably April or early May, Kentucky Derby weekend every year, it seems like. So early May of 07 was my first AAU event. And so, you know, you're talking about 13 years. That's not that long in reality, but there's just a lot more coverage and there's a lot more teams and there's a lot more kids playing. And so there's a lot more noise and names to sift through. I think the reality is there's still the same number of players that are good enough to play, but there's more people fighting for those spots. And so I think that in a way makes it more difficult to kind of just be decisive and concise and put your filters on it. You know, what are your filters that spit people out on the other end to evaluate? And so I think in that way, there is a more complexity to it at our level, you know, in particular where, you know, we're not going to the EYBL and that's our recruiting. You know, I would love to go to the EYBL. I'd love to recruit kids at the EYBL. But, you know, for us, it's we're seeing a wide range of ability levels. Some kids are playing because they just like to play. And that's great. I love that about it. And other kids are playing because it's really important to them and they want a scholarship. And all those people are in the same event. And that can be – there are challenges to that.
Yeah, it seems like the funnel is maybe a lot bigger than it used to be, in that because you have so many kids playing, it just feels like the beginning part of the evaluation of how do we even narrow down that huge list that we have into guys that we're really going to want to recruit. That seems like it would be a challenge. And then I also think about the fact that because there's so many more kids who are more skilled, I would have to think that there's still clearly the elite players, whether it's you define elite by players who are going to go play Division I or you have players who are going to be elite Division II players. There's still those players out there. And then clearly within an AAU environment, you have a bunch of kids who are completely unrecruitable, either because of their skill level or because, as you said, maybe a kid's just out there playing to have fun. But I would think that this middle group of kids that kind of is all meshed together, that that's kind of what makes it difficult, is that there's probably not much separation between that middle 40% of the kids who are in tournaments. That's the part that would seem to me to be difficult. It would be to narrow down who do we really want to focus on out of this whole big list of kids who are playing AAU basketball and who theoretically might be recruitable.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. I think the other challenge, honestly, is there is like a proliferation of transfers and other paths to end up with the right kind of people, you know? And so in those kind of those options are so much later than when you're watching someone in May, June, July going into their senior year, or obviously May, June, July of their junior year, even obviously at certainly the Division I level. And so I think balancing those things has certainly become more challenging for coaches. And the other part I'd say, and I don't know if this is right, certainly coaches with more experience than I have and a little bit older than me would know this better, but I certainly feel like when I started in 07 at a Division II school, there weren't as many programs working as hard as there are today.
you know, like there weren't as many people at summer AAU events or spring AAU events. There weren't as many schools, I don't think, that were valuing that element of it. And over time, I think you have more people that want to be in coaching and appreciate it. And so they pursue it as a career. And so it creates more emphasis on it. And I think that obviously makes it a more competitive environment too. You know what I mean? You just have more people trying to be as good as they can be. And that wasn't always, I don't think that was always the case at the Division II. And I can't speak to the Division III level because I haven't coached at it. But I imagine that would trickle down to the Division III level as well.
Well, and then I've got to believe that to some degree that falls into social media playing into that in terms of being aware of what is going on with other programs and just being a tap away from, you know, on your phone that you carry around with you all the time, that you can see that this player mentioned this offer or this player is playing in this tournament or this coach is doing this thing and everybody is kind of on there. And so I think there's probably a hyper awareness of what other schools and other coaches and other players are doing that didn't exist in the past. And then I think the other thing that you mentioned is just the fact that coaching and wanting to work within the realm of sports. And again, we can go beyond just coaching basketball, but just the number of people that want to work in sports and the competition for coaching jobs is just incredible. I mean, I'm sure you know and are well aware that you can put out a job that pays nothing and has super long hours, but is a foot in the door, and you're going to get 200 resumes coming in of people who want that job just because they want the opportunity to work in college basketball. Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off. So I guess that leads you to, or leads us to, the next sort of step in your path. If we go back in time, you get done with your playing career and you graduate and you don't immediately head into the coaching profession, which makes you a rarity in the game. So talk to us a little bit about your mindset when you graduated. Where were you with the game of basketball? Why at that point maybe was coaching not on your radar? And then what happened to flip that switch where you decided, hey, I really want to get back into the game and coaching is a way for me to be able to do that? So tell us a little bit about that period in your life and how you came to return to the game as a coach.
Yeah, so when I got started at Lawrence, I was going to be a history major, do education, and become, I thought I was going to become a high school teacher and figured I would coach at the high school level. And honestly, at some point during my sophomore year, I had an education class, and it was the first time that part of the syllabus had me not shadowing, but getting out, logging hours in a classroom, essentially, and just sort of, you know, spending 25 hours in a high school classroom and just taking notes on it and all that kind of stuff. And I went to my very first, I'm going to call it shadowing. I feel like not remembering the right word for this, but, and I sat down, and it was at a Catholic high school in Appleton, Wisconsin, Xavier. And I sat in the back of the room, and I am not kidding you that it was probably a 50-minute class. And by the time I walked out of that class and out of the front doors of Appleton Xavier, I knew I was not going to be a teacher. I didn't feel any connection. I felt like It seemed like something I don't know if good at is even the right word, just wouldn't be happy doing. And I can't sit here and say this reason, this reason, this reason. I'm not sure. It just was like something deep in me was like rebelling against this being my future. And so I essentially changed courses and I just got a history degree. I would have done probably a business degree, but at Lawrence, we're a liberal arts school. And so we only had econ. We didn't have, you know, like business management, which probably would have made, you know, sense for me. And so I graduated. I didn't really know what I was going to do. A buddy of mine from high school worked at a company called Caremark, which is now called CVS Caremark. And as I was interviewing for that job, I also applied at the inaugural Masters of Sports Administration class at Northwestern, you know, in Evanston, and have a Chicago campus. And I got in and I got the job. And so I spent really a semester working a full-time job and doing the classes at night, or maybe like two terms, I should say. And then I decided to move out to Denver with the girl I had been dating from college, and just felt pretty miserable, truthfully. I mean, I look back and I'm really disappointed because I got to live with my brother and living in Chicago. I mean, there's so many good things about it. Many of my friends were in Chicago at that time, but I just was miserable. And I thought moving to Denver with this young lady was an answer. And of course, as it usually is when you're not married yet, it's not really an answer. And so we went out there. My Caremark let me keep my job, and I worked out of the apartment, and our relationship fell apart very quickly. And I think that reality and that loneliness of being in Denver truthfully caused me to evaluate what I was doing. You know, what was the cause of my own unhappiness, and where did it come from? And I really felt strongly that it came from not necessarily being away from basketball specifically as a sport, but being away from the team environment. You know what I mean? That environment where it's a group of people working towards something. And so I was able to volunteer at a D-League team in just north of Denver in Broomfield. Joe Wolf was the head coach, and he was kind enough to let me volunteer. And really, I just did, I don't even know what I did, just grunt labor and you know, lineup tracking, and did some filming. And, you know, I was probably, you know, trying to figure out how to do some video things, but wasn't quite smart enough, you know, all that kind of stuff. And just being there, I can remember the first day I was there was part of their tryouts, and they put me up in this scissor lift, you know, that had like a canopy, and just went straight up in the air, whatever, 25 feet, and thing was swaying, and I was pretty sure I was going to fall. But I just filmed the first day of tryouts, and I found myself even just standing up there and like doing my part of this enterprise and feeling better and just feeling like, hey, this is something I'm supposed to pursue. And so I stayed with them really until the spring. And at some point kind of between probably February and April, I reached out to Coach Tharp back at Lawrence and just said, hey, you know, I'm going to come back to Appleton. I'm going to get into a master's program nearby and I'll volunteer. And he kind of kept me at arm's length. And I didn't understand why. It made no sense. I'm like offering free help. I'm like, I'll figure out the rest. Come. And he was like, I'm not sure. Let's talk about it in a couple weeks. Time kept passing and I was kind of getting frustrated. But what soon I discovered is he was in the process of going to Hillsdale and possibly taking that job and ultimately taking that job. And so once he got it, he offered me a part-time, no benefits role that included a room in the house that five or six players lived in and $5,000. And, you know, I was working in a corporate, you know, Fortune 500 job. And, you know, in my opinion, I was making really good money. You know, I didn't even make that much money again for several years. And I just felt like I had to do it. And I said, cool, I'm going to do it. And I told my parents, you know, what I was going to do. And like good quality parents, they were like, what are you talking about? Asking me about insurance and health insurance, car insurance, you know, how much do I make now? What was I going to make? How was I going to make ends meet? All that kind of stuff. And they were kind enough to put me back on car insurance and kind enough to buy me essentially a catastrophic
healthcare policy for a few hundred bucks that just, you know, if something terrible happened to me, I wasn't going to be crippled, you know, for the rest of my life financially. And I literally picked up and moved from Denver, Colorado. A college teammate of mine, a buddy of mine came for the weekend. We loaded up a 17-foot box truck, put my Honda Accord on the back of it, and we drove 17 hours, dropped my stuff at Cary. I walked into the office the next day and said, these are my 2 weeks' notice. And 2 weeks later, I was at that Spiess Running Slam. And really, from the day I got to Hillsdale, I felt like this is what I was supposed to be doing. And certainly Hillsdale opened a lot of doors for me in terms of my own development. And I met my wife in Hillsdale. And but it was just like I worked my butt off, and Coach Tharp did as well. And we were ultimately able to have enough success to open other doors. And I really feel a lot of that has just been because I was willing to pursue something and willing to listen to kind of what, you know, the gods were telling me was kind of my path.
What was it about coaching that you really liked? What, I mean, obviously you have a job that was well paying, you had a career path that, you know, you were on, and then you go and you take this glamorous job to earn $5,000 and live in a house with a bunch of players. You take the typical route of everybody wants to be a glamorous college basketball coach, and you get that first job. What was it that you liked about it?
I think it was purpose. You know, I think it was just purpose. I think working at that in that corporate environment, I think great corporations, and obviously Caremark wasn't. I think I was just too young to realize it. But you know, I had a hard time finding my purpose within it. And seeing myself in that world for my life, you know, and for my future. And so I think when I was volunteering for the D-League team, it reminded me that, you know, how to work towards something together, like truly be invested in something. And certainly that's a professional level, so it's different, you know, than the college level, but it opened the door to that for me. And just the personal relationships, you know, just the idea of, like, you know, Coach Wolf was very nice to me and was open and treated me like a member of the team and of the staff. And I appreciated that about him. And in a lot of ways, his willingness to let me volunteer, I think, saved me in many ways. And so I think just being a part of a group again and having that common goal. And I think what that purpose is probably altered as I've gotten older. You know, initially it's just about winning. You know, it's about literally, like, when I got to Hillsdale, it's like, let's win. Let's do whatever we got to do to win, you know, within in terms of hours and the effort we need to put in and the traveling and the recruiting and the whatever else, right? Let's just do this to win. And then over time, I feel like recognizing that you're having an impact on people. You know, I think ultimately I've found that being a coach is my way of impacting the world for the better. And I am far, far from perfect, but I do think I care, and our staff and the programs I've been a part of genuinely care about the future of our players and their development. And I think when young people are in that environment, they're better off and they have the opportunity to grow and be in a better place on the back end of being at a school and in a program. And I think it ultimately came down to purpose, you know, having it and embracing it and recognizing it.
Yeah. I think that's something that, as you said, a lot of young coaches come into it with the idea, I think at first, that you want to win. And I think that starts out being the purpose. And I think the longer you're in it, and as you get older, especially if you get married and you have a family and you start to change up your priorities and you start to realize that, yes, winning is important. And clearly at the level where you're coaching, you're judged on wins and losses. But there's also this whole other piece of being able to have an impact and using a game of basketball that we love to be able to have an impact on lives. And I think a lot of coaches eventually get to that same place where you've gotten where, yeah, you still want to win. It still burns in you. But there's this whole other thing that goes along with it that you're having an impact on the players that are with you every single day. And, you know, you're going to see maybe that pay off in the short term. Maybe you'll see the results, but you're more likely to see those results 5, 10, 15, 20 years on down the line when your players come back to visit or say thanks or remember something that you did and tell you the story about wearing the yellow shorts or getting to wear the headband. Those are things that I think are invaluable, that means so much to all of us who have coached any time, those players that we've been able to have an impact on, not just as basketball players, but as human beings moving forward. And so as you think about being able to live out your purpose, and obviously at some point as you're moving through and you're working as an assistant at Hillsdale, you start thinking about maybe at some point you'd like to have an opportunity to run your own program. What did you do to prepare yourself to eventually become a head coach? Once that kind of got on your radar, that was something that you thought you might want to do, what did you begin to do to prepare yourself for that opportunity? Whether it was just keeping a journal of things that you wanted to remember, maybe it was just putting together a philosophy or creating your resume and putting it in a format that you thought would be beneficial to getting a head coaching job. What did you do to prepare?
Well, I think one of the things that I feel like helped me, truthfully, helped me help Hillsdale be the best program it could be while I was there, is just I was hyper focused on that job and what I was doing, in this case, for Coach Tharp and for Hillsdale basketball. You know, I was not, I have to admit, I was not very focused on my future. You know, I was not very focused on my next step. I wasn't then, and to be honest, don't feel like now I'm a great like networker, connector. I really am focused on what we needed to do to be successful. And it got to the point where I was probably getting to my late 20s and I had just gotten married or was about to get married. And Coach pretty much told me like, hey, now you need to start looking for head jobs. And we had been successful. So I didn't think he was trying to fire me. And so I felt like it was genuine that, hey, like, now's your time. Like, you're getting to that age, you need to start preparing. I think the big thing that, as I look back on it, that helped me is that Coach Tharp allowed me to be involved in every element of our program. Like, there was nothing from budget to travel to on floor to strategy to scouts to film to recruiting to, you know, academic monitoring. I mean, there was nothing that went on in our program that I was not deeply immersed in, and in many cases in charge of, from a young age. You know, from a young age. I mean, and I think that experience of just kind of being thrown in the deep end a little bit helped me a great deal feel like I was ready. Now, when I went through my first round of interviews, you know, and whenever that would have been, summer of or spring of 12 or spring of 11, whenever it would have been, I had to put stuff on paper, you know, and needing to do that and really sort through my own feelings was a big help for me to like identify my own philosophies. How did they dovetail what we were doing, but what was different? What did I want to convey? And the ability to sort of verbalize that over the course of my first set of interviews, one off season, I want to say it would have been the off season of 12 then, really gave me a lot of like insight into myself. And then when it got to the off season of 13, I was way more prepared. You know, I had a way better sense of how to communicate those things and what I actually believed in. And I also felt very buoyed by the idea that I didn't really want to leave Hillsdale. Like, I didn't feel some like burning desire to like to do another job, to get a head coaching job even. You know, I was excited to do it. I wanted to do it, but I didn't feel like if it didn't happen, I was going to be lost. And so I think because of that second round of interviews, I was just wholly committed to being brutally honest about how I felt and what my opinions were and what I thought was best. And I think that gave me great comfort and great confidence in all of my sort of processes that particular round.
So what were some things that you brought to the table to those interviews that you said, these are my philosophies, these are the things that I believe in, that maybe you wouldn't have in that first set of interviews?
I think from an outline standpoint, just like this is how I would, I honestly, the second time I tried to more specifically break down every single element of the program and exactly how I would run it, you know, and the first round, I think I had like the sort of framework of that, but not really the detail of it. The ironic thing to me is that I didn't really end up feeling like I ever shared it all with any job. Like I had it, I worked on it, I was aggressive in my pursuit of understanding and having it ready. But when it came down to it, like that process of getting it ready almost embedded it in my mind. And so I never really felt like I had to use it in a literal sense. Like we did video interviews, which I'm sure were like Skype or whatever, and some conference call interviews because it wasn't as prevalent to do all video interviews at that point. And so I communicated a lot of those things within the questions. But when I got on campus, I had printed out copies that were those very detailed, like, this is how we're going to do this, from all those things I said earlier, from recruiting through on floor, through practice, through weightlifting, through academic monitoring, and so on. I had it out there. I had it ready, but I feel like I handed it to like two people and never even really specifically went over it with them because those answers were just in the rest of my communication.
No, that makes total sense. And I think that as you go through the process and you become more confident and you become more organized and you just understand what the interview process is going to be like and what kind of questions they're going to ask you, it seems like it's a no-brainer that you're going to be better at it the second time around than you are the first time. So let's talk a little bit about this, just your growth as a head coach from your first year at Ohio Dominican to where you are now at North Georgia. What are some things that you feel like you've gotten better at or that you have a tighter handle on today than you had in your first year as a head coach?
I think there's I think as head coaches, I'll speak for myself, I suspect I'm not alone. There's a certain amount of anxiety that just comes with being in this world and in this job, right? Like there's just a certain amount of, I think, inherent fear of being good enough. I think that's true for most people in every part of their life, right? And I think having had the experience at Ohio Dominican and really building a program, you know, from the ground up, you know, it gave me confidence that the things I believe in are right and true. And I think the things I believe in are not as much about a way to play in a literal sense, but just what's important to accomplish within our program. And that confidence, I think I earned through years and with significant help from staff and from players, made me a lot more prepared to handle a job like this, which is, you know, in certain ways more complex and is in a tremendous league and, you know, one with several established programs that are of national quality. But having earned that confidence, I feel like the foundation I feel internally, both mentally, emotionally, is just stronger. You know, my convictions are stronger. My ability to set a better standard and a better tone day to day is better right now than in my second year at ODU. You know, I just learned a lot through that and the ability that I feel I'm capable of, but most especially that I can pull hopefully out of our staff and players. And that confidence comes with time. Like it's different. Like being an assistant, being a head coach is different. And it's hard to say what the difference is, but you know it immediately, you know? And I honestly occasionally, especially when I first got started as a head coach, would call Coach Tharp, even though we were in the same league. So our, you know, those conversations were a little different than had we been in different leagues. I would just almost apologize to him, like, hey, I'm sorry I didn't know what you were going through. Like, I tried to be the best, but I'm sorry I didn't know all this stuff that you were probably going through internally. And I hope I was there for you, you know, because it's different. It's different. And I think having gone through that at ODU has prepared me tremendously to be a lot better at those things here.
How do you go about setting the tone for what you want your program to be about, both with your coaching staff and with your players? Is that something that you have a specific plan that you lay out, or is that something that just day to day through your experience and through the things that you've learned along the way in your career that you're able to create through those day to day interactions with both staff and players? Do you think that's something that you plan out meticulously, or is it something that happens as a result of your experience? Not that you're not intentional about it, but maybe it's just more of an organic day-to-day thing as opposed to, let's say, a year-long plan of how you're going to establish what your culture is all about.
I think there's kind of a middle ground. Like, we have some things we're very specific about that we expect our players to uphold, you know? And I don't mean that like from a behavioral standpoint, like in a literal like rules. I mean, like, we expect them to be certain things. And, you know, for us, we talk about, we have four guidelines. Ultimately, we want to be early, be ready, be competitive, and be connected. And we really want our guys to uphold those four B statements in everything they do. And that is the expectation. You know what I mean? That is a standard of performance in everything they do. And so that is very specific. Now, when you drill down to those things, it's not like we have a bullet point of like what that means or what you have to do to achieve those things. Those become more about day-to-day emphasis, you know, kind of group discipline in terms of holding each other accountable and us as a staff holding our players and ourselves accountable to those things. And I think there's just a certain level of kind of toughness mentally and physically that comes with setting that tone. And the other part is like how we practice, how we lift. Like, we want those things to be hard. You know, we want those things to be hard. And that day to day is a little bit more, you know, I can't put my finger on what that is, but that's a little bit more of that kind of feeling and culture that develops over time, more than just, hey, this is on a piece of paper, so now we're going to do it. You know, that's more of an evolution.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think there's an overarching plan, and yet it's the day-to-day execution of what you do day in and day out, how you interact with the players, how you interact with your staff, what the expectations are that you set. There's an intentional piece of it, but then there's also the day-to-day of, we've got to set the tone based around these parameters that we've set up. We are closing in on an hour and a half, Dan, and I want to ask you one final question that I've kind of been using to wrap up episodes lately, and that is, share with us what you think about being your biggest challenge moving forward. And I've kind of asked people to put aside the pandemic as a challenge, since we're all kind of facing that. But let's imagine that at some point things go back to normal. What do you see as your biggest challenge at the University of North Georgia? And then after you answer the challenge question, what is your biggest joy? What do you get excited about when you get up in the bed, out of bed in the morning to go to work? What's the biggest joy? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Well, I think the biggest challenge is cementing our identity and then recruiting to that identity. You know, I moved here from the Midwest, you know, from, I was in Columbus and Michigan before that, and grew up in suburban Chicago. And so cementing our identity within our program and then making sure that we are supporting that identity every day with our behaviors and with our what we emphasize, and then recruiting to that same identity. I think there are a tremendous amount of talented people and players here in Georgia specifically, but even in the Southeast overall, and just making sure that we're comfortable pursuing the players that fit us and what we're trying to be, more than just collecting good players. You know, like, I'm
I think it was Mike Lombardi who may have been sort of quoting Belichick or Parcells or Bill Walsh or somebody or Al Davis, but it's like, we are in the business of building a program, not collecting talent. And I think at our school, it's important that we are a program, not just a collection of talent, because it is, it's a good academic school. There's just, there's factors to it that I think allow us to be a great program. And so I think building that identity, cementing it, and then making sure that everything we do pushes toward it is the greatest challenge, which may be true anywhere you are, but certainly I feel that way about us here as we continue to kind of get into year two. As far as joy, there's a lot, honestly. I think I have a great enthusiasm for life. I think my players would say the same thing, but there's a few things that I just love to do. One, I just love being around our players in whatever the setting is. Like if we're in practice, awesome. Film, awesome. Community service event, awesome. Like hanging out in the office, great. You know, like I lift in the weight room, great. Like I love being around our players. And I think that is absolutely something I enjoy getting out of bed for every single day. The other thing for me is getting to read to my kids at night. I love reading to my son and my daughter when we put them to bed. Like, though, you know, I shouldn't leave my wife out. I love being around my wife too. Though being around my players and getting to read to my children are things that, you know, like I in the moment, I know how lucky I am. You know, I can acknowledge how lucky I am every single time I get those experiences and certainly try to cherish them as much as I can.
What's your favorite set of books you read to your kids? Do you have a favorite?
So my son, who is going to be 5 right after Christmas, we bought a Flat Stanley book, which is
nice
for him in terms of like, he can't read that book, but we've been reading Flat Stanley books and he just loves them. So for him, it's either Flat Stanley or The Avengers. Those are the two like books. We have like 5-minute stories or, you know, those sort of storybook ones that, so those are for him. My daughter, she'll be 3 in late February. So for her, it's like this, we have some Minnie Mouse books. She loves Minnie Mouse and she just discovered or, you know, we were introduced to something called Fancy Nancy, and she loves Fancy Nancy. I don't quite get Fancy Nancy, to be honest with you, but she loves Fancy Nancy. So I would say those are the books that we're pretty bought into.
Let me vouch for the fact that there's going to be a lot of things that you don't understand as they go through and they get a little older. That you're going to be like, why do they like this? I don't get it. So I went through a lot of stretches. My big thing with that was Pokemon cards. I'm like, my son for a long time would collect those. And I'd be like, why would you rather collect these than collect basketball cards or baseball cards? It never made any sense to me. But at any rate, you will find that there are a lot of things that your kids do and enjoy that you're like, I don't think I ever would have liked or enjoyed that. But they are who they are. And that's part of the fun of being a parent is seeing what they end up doing. Dan, this has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Before we get out of here, I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find out more about your program, how they can connect with you, maybe share out your social media, give the school's website so that people can find out more about the great things that you're doing down there at the University of North Georgia.
That put me on the spot. I'm not even sure if I know my Twitter handle, so look it up. I am at @CoachEvans_UNG. Our men's basketball page is at UNGMBB. You know, if you search North Georgia Athletics, our university website, I believe pops up. And so those are places to find us. I have to admit, there's no element of self-promotion for me. So like my Twitter is not very exciting, but my staff does a really good job on our Twitter and our external operations people do a great job on our universities or on our athletic department's Twitter. So the website and our school Twitter and our athletic, our basketball Twitter are all good stuff.
Dan, cannot thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight and taking that time out of your schedule. We really do appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.